Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle's on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super studcast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
The Stud has history with many stars from wrestling's past. He has tremendous respect for two brothers that left their mark on the great sport of professional wrestling. They began wrestling much earlier than that as two of the best amateur wrestlers of all time. One of them is with us today on this very special Super Studcast and is still very much a part of professional wrestling. The other, sadly, has passed but will never be forgotten. They were the Briscoe Brothers. One was the NWA World Champion Jack Briscoe. The other is still one of the most respected wrestlers and businessmen ever, Jerry Briscoe. Ron is proud to welcome Jerry Briscoe to another historic Super Studcast. Fans will hear today a story of how two Oklahoma brothers captured the hearts of fans all over the world.
The Studcast, and welcome back for another Super Studcast, and this is a championship edition because we have on the line with us a man who held so many titles, from the World Tag Team title to the Florida Heavyweight Championship to the World's Junior Heavyweight Championship and so many in between, maybe even in Southeastern. But before we get there, let me introduce the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Brian. I'm really happy to be here and really proud of who we've got on today. He and I go back about 50 years, a long, long time. I had a great relationship with his brother. And this guy is a tremendous, tremendous wrestler, a great athlete, businessman. He's still in it. After all these years, he's still working with WWE as a scout. Amateur scout and just a great friend and a great guy, a very respected guy in wrestling, and has earned all those honors. And I'm really proud to have him on. And I think if you're on the air, Jerry, glad to have you with us, my man.
Oh, Ron, I can't tell you how thrilled I am. A little bit over a year ago, I guess you started the Studcast. As soon as I saw it on Twitter that you were starting a podcast, I knew it would be very successful because, as you say, and it's a scary thing to say, but we do go back around 50 years. Wow. Who would have thought that? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first time I saw you, I think you were down in Miami. You were just getting ready to break into business. I'd just gotten the business myself, and we're both young guys, and we're looking around the dressing room, and Florida back in those days, Eddie kept a lot of old timers around, and all of a sudden, we're the young boys in the dressing room. Hell, a blink of the eye, all of a sudden we're the oldest guys in the dressing room. So, how time flies, but it's an honor to be on your Studcast.
Oh, well, I appreciate it, Jerry, so much, man. And yeah, you're right. We did start about the same time. And I and your brother had a great relationship. Jack and I was a very, very good
brother. I would have, wow.
Jack and I had a great relationship for sure. And I got to meet you and spend some time with you. You were kind of in and out from the very beginning. Once we got started, you would come in, you would work tag matches with Jack quite a bit. And I looked at you as being kind of just like Jack, just as qualified and had the same type of background. And so today we're just going to go through the Briscoe history here. And I've noticed that you have six family members. Six members in your family. Is that correct?
That's correct. And unfortunately, I've lost two of my brothers. I've lost Jack around 10 years ago and my brother Bill. I think you met Bill. Bill was a guy that should have been in the business, wanted to be in the business, but he was a car guy, and those car guys are kind of like wrestlers. Once you get hooked on those cars, you're hooked on them. he became general manager of a big Cadillac place and was making plenty of money. And we kept telling him, Bill, don't risk that long-term career over something that could be over with in a day. You know?
Oh, yeah. Good, solid advice for darn sure. You know, and I don't know what, I know that you've got Indian blood, obviously. And I never had a chance to talk to you about a whole lot of things, but my great-grandfather was a full-blooded Osage Indian. And I don't know where that is in relationship to Blackwell, Oklahoma, where you're from, but is that anywhere near where you are or where you are?
I could tell you Osage Indians were, and you were born of the right blood, but we used to call the Osage and the Pawnee the rich Indians in Oklahoma, because the Osage back during the after the Civil War, when they decided, you know, the Native Americans weren't fit to inhabit the South and the Alabama and Mississippi, and they did the Trail of Tears, the Forced March. The Osage was part of the march out to Oklahoma. So the Osage got out there early. They were non-resistant, so the government kind of leaned kind of towards them, and they gave them the land of their choice, and they went, you know, picked some land out in Oklahoma, kind of resembled Alabama and Mississippi, and got into kind of the mountains land, and but the thing underneath that land was that black gold, as they called it, and they struck oil on their property, and the Osage became one of the wealthiest tribes in the United States, and there's a movie coming out soon. I think it's called The Summer Moon or something like that. That you ought to get the book and read it. It's a good book on the Osage and the Pawnee and the Indians out in that era out there. How the white men didn't think they were fit enough to manage their wealth, and of course they assigned governorships to the natives out there, and of course the white people were named the governors of the land and of the money that was coming out of the oil there, and of course they swindled the Indians out of all the land, and a lot of murders took place. There was a period of time where I think there was like 20 some odd murders of wealthy Native Americans, and that was all done by the governorships of the properties out there. But yeah, we could be somewhere along that woodpile, you know, related somewhere, because my tribe grew up right next to your tribe.
Oh, that's cool, man. I never knew that about you.
I'm a Chickasaw Choctaw is what I am.
Oh, okay. So, you know, I never knew that history, and you're right. I need to get that book, you know, and I think, you know, I've heard, and I don't know that this is true, but I heard that your father was kind of like my great-grandfather. He was a Roman type, and he would just leave. Sometimes the family, my granddad, Roy Welch, who was the first guy in the family that started wrestling in the early 20s, 1920. And, wow. You know, Roy and Herb and those boys, when they were growing up, my great-granddad, Ed Welch, he'd disappear. He would just leave one day, and he wouldn't say anything to anybody, and he'd come back 3 years later. You know, he'd be gone for 2-3 years. And, you know, I don't know if you had that same type of upbringing, but, you know, it's pretty strange. I guess and that had a lot to do with the fact that, you know, just what the Indians are all about. And I mean, they were
the wanderers.
There you go. There you go, man. And
I certainly did. I had the same type. My father, you know, my mother was the Indian of the bunch. And, my father was a German Irish guy, and my mom come from there was the Dawes Act. Henry Dawes, the Secretary of State at the time, he was the one assigned to certify all the natives that they moved out from Alabama and Mississippi. So where there's the Dawes Rose, and you go on there, if you go back, if you find the proper names, you can go back to like 4 or 5 generations, find your names on those Dawes Rose, and you never know what you're entitled to. You know, of course, my son, Joe, he's an architect now, and he got all of his education paid for by the Native Americans, by the Chickasaw tribe. So there's still some advantages to being a Native American, but we're still looked on in some parts of the country as third-class citizens. And that's one of my causes now. I said I'm always on social media, you know, blasting, change the mascot. I'm not a, Washington's an NFL football club member. I like the team, and I like the coaches, and I like some of the players, but I hate their nicknames and their logos. So, it's, you know, we're in the 2020s now. Come on, guys, NFL. Get with the times and change it. But that's my political spiel. I won't hit back on that. But the Fuller name, if people in the Welsh name, if they would just do some research, and then right now this generation of wrestling fans have the greatest opportunity in the world because of the research that we can do now. I wish I'd had this, you know, we'd had this back in the day. You can go back and research anything, but you research that Welsh Fuller name, truly pioneers of the professional wrestling business, and it was professional wrestling, and it is professional wrestling, and of the business. So the Welches, they were pioneers in every state in the South, helped pioneer the great sport that you and I got to grow into and be a part of. And I've always respected that name, and I've worked for that name. I never got to work in your dad's territory, but, you know, through Georgia and Florida and everything, we became friends, and you and your brother and my brother and myself. Ronald, more my age than you, were tilting towards Jack's age there, but Ronald, Robert and I, we spent so many nights out on that lake there in his boat with Bob Armstrong, some of those other guys. Party and raising hell. We were meant to be related to each other.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I'm sure if you was out there with Rob and Bob and some of that group, man, y'all were raising some hell too. No doubt about that.
Yeah.
I never realized that y'all were on Lake Lanier together. And what a beautiful lake that is, man. A beautiful, beautiful part of the country. And you spent a lot of time in Georgia. I know that at different times in your career, and kind of been everywhere. I want to drop back to where things all started with you and with Jack, too. You know, I know that you were a great athlete in school, and you played sports in school. What sports were you really into before you went to college? I know you went to college, too, at Oklahoma State. Is that right? For a little time?
That's correct. You know, I was, you know, just so country boy from Blackwell, Oklahoma. We had a population about 4,000 or 5,000 people in a little town at that time. And Jack, you know, being five years older than me, and I had two other brothers, Gene and Bill. Bill was one that just passed away about a year and a half ago. But Gene's 86 years old, and he's still kicking and doing great. But Gene was the first one of us that was an athlete. He was a big, tall guy like you, and he was actually a small college All-American basketball player and a football player in a little town called Bowlegs, Oklahoma, population 200. And the Briscoe name, and my brother Bill followed after that, and he was quite a football player also. They didn't have wrestling in that little town. But to make a long story short, my old man was into alcohol too much, and he actually died of cirrhosis being an alcoholic and leaving my mom with six kids. But one day he got the wild idea. We had allotment land that the government had given our family for being Native Americans and making that move. Well, he took our land and decided to sell it without my mom's permission. Sold the land, loaded us all in a truck. We moved out by San Francisco, San Leandro, California, out there. And he kept us out there about 2 months and decided he didn't want a family out there. So he put us on a Trailways bus and sent us to Blackwell, Oklahoma, where he had some relatives there. So here's my mom in the 50s, a single mom right after all the Great Depression, right after the Dust Bowl days in Oklahoma. We were sent back to Oklahoma. My mom with six kids, no job, no land, no livelihood, no nothing. She was able to get a job. She had two jobs and supported family, sent four out of six of us to college. Just a couple of us had athletic scholarships, so that helped. But she did an outstanding job raising us. So I never had too much of a relationship with my old man, never had no respect for him, never. I didn't even, when he passed away, I didn't even acknowledge it, and I couldn't tell you to this day where he's at, where he's buried, all that stuff. And quite honestly, I know it sounds kind of harsh, but I really don't give a damn, you know, because he didn't give a damn about us. But, you know, my mom was a good Christian lady, and like I said, she raised six of us, made sure we went to Sunday school every day, made sure we did our homework, and was able to put us through school, and sports was a way out. I mean, you know, that's what you did if you wanted out of poverty. So My brother was an exceptional athlete, Jack, and as my brother Gene and Bill were. And so I just kind of followed along with them, picked up the used gloves and the used balls, and we'd go out and play in the neighborhood. And we developed a skill, worked hard at what we did because of our upbringing and everything. And we both were able to pursue wrestling scholarships at Oklahoma State University. My brother went on and won a national title. I went on and was a scholarship wrestler there for 3.5 years before health issues forced me out of school. And Jack had already turned pro wrestling. The pro wrestling promoter, a great little short story of sports fans out there in general, the great Bud Wilkinson. I'm sure you heard that name, right?
Oh, heck yeah. Oklahoma coach.
He was the Lord of coaches. He was like Paul Bear Bryant, and he recruited Jack out of high school. And Jack had signed a scholarship to play football there, but he's a 3-time state champion wrestler. So the Myron Roderick, the wrestling coach at Oklahoma State, heard that Jack was a big pro wrestling fan because of Danny Hodge and some of the other guys that they had around at the time. And so he called Leroy, who was an Oklahoma State national champion, told Leroy about Jack. Jack wanted to become a pro wrestler, but he'd signed a scholarship for OU to play football, and Roderick really wanted him. He asked McGurk if he would call Jack and tell Jack as soon as he got out of college there would be a pro wrestling contract waiting for him there. So McGurk called Jack, and he did better than that. He sent a couple of the old-time wrestlers, Big Boy Brown with Grizzly Smith, and a couple of Bundy Monroe, a couple of other guys came over to Blackwell and actually recruited Jack. Jack dropped his scholarship letter of intent to Bud Wilkinson. OU signed a wrestling scholarship. So that was some of the old 60s style of recruiting back then. Roderick was pretty sharp, found out what the kid liked and pursued it and got the guy that he wanted, and he turned into a national champion for him. So, of course, when I got out of high school, I had several scholarship offers to go wrestle around the country. And I actually was a day away from signing with the University of Colorado. And my mom found out I was really leaning toward going to Colorado. And, of course, she didn't want me leaving town. And so she called my brother. My brother called Roderick. And like 2.5 hours later, after the news leaked out, Roderick and I was there at my house was a scholarship. My mom, of course, made me sign the scholarship for Oklahoma State University. So that's basically how I ended up there. And I had a fair career. I didn't have the career my brother had, but very few people did. But that was kind of our Oklahoma State. Then when I was ready to go, Jack contacted me, and he took me over to meet Leroy. And as you know, Ronald, the strange thing, Leroy McGurk was totally blind. He couldn't see. So he had loaded his territory with old timers that he remembered when he could still had his sight, you know, and all these guys were young and muscular and built and everything. But, you know, like time gets everybody, they'd all turn into old guys. So his territory was surrounded by older guys, older wrestlers. So when I come in, you know, like I said before, I was the youngest guy in the dressing room. And so, but what a learning experience. If young guys, when they go in these dressing rooms, they take the time, they break down, they study these guys. And I don't mean so much study them what they do in the ring, but study them backstage. Study how they conduct themselves, especially the top guys, the Luthezes, the Gene Kinesis, the Pat O'Connors, the guys that would come into those dressing rooms. They were all successful because of a reason. And I wanted to know why they were successful. So I broke down how they walked into the dressing room, how they meet and greeted guys, how they unpacked their suitcases, how they packed their suitcases, how they walked to the ring. All the little details that are missing in some of today's talent, you know, because they don't have those experiences that we had. But I would break them down, and I'd study each and every little mannerism they would do, how they would act in a restaurant, how they would act in a bar, and then, you know, just how they would treat people. And you just learn so much. There's so much opportunity, like I said, with the internet nowadays to pay attention to these guys. So I did it a couple of years in Oklahoma, and then got the opportunity. Jack had already been over to Australia, and Jim Barnett liked him. And so Jim said, I hear you got a brother. So of course, Jim brought me over, and I ended up spending a year over there, which I was really blessed because of the talent level that was over there. And I'd only been in the business about a year and a half, so I was working with guys like Killer Kowalski, Mark Lewin, Ian Curtis, Mr. Foodie, some of the Riptide are some of the greatest names of the history of professional wrestling. So Rip Hawk, Sweet Hansen were over there. They liked me. They were headed into the Carolinas. And so they got me into the Carolinas, which was really good because Florida was just right down the road from the Carolinas. And you're right when you said I was in and out of there a lot because Jack and I had kind of a special deal going where tag teams were hot. So we're feuding with the Funk Brothers. So Eddie would have that down in Florida on the good nights. And then on the other nights, he would send us up to Carolina. So we got to do that Funk Briscoe feud, you know, throughout the Southern United States, and it got over because you had four young athletes going at it there. And so I've really been blessed and fortunate being in the right place at the right time in my career.
Oh man. You've earned all that stuff too. I really appreciate what you're saying about looking at those old timers because I used to watch Luke Thez work for me several times in Southeastern and I'd been on cards with him before. And he had a way of doing he was methodical when he got to the dressing room and he had his bag open. He always had one of those silver bags long before anybody else had. And the way he did things. And my grandfather used to tell me Roy was really good friends with Leroy. He said, you know, Leroy was blind. He couldn't see anything. He said, but he could probably tell you more about a match by listening to it than you watching it.
Well, I'm glad you said it. The most amazing thing I've ever seen and heard in my life, and I tell people that, and they still call me a flat-ass liar on this. Leroy McGuirk, as you know, was color man on his own TV show, and he could tell by the sound of the bump what the guy had taken, and he knew exactly what it was. He very rarely missed the call, too. He could hear that bump. If it's two bump, well, he took a backdrop. Or if it's one bump, he took an easy dead or roll up. But it was amazing. But he didn't have a sight, but, you know, they say they get that extra sense of that. He has hearing. He was so familiar with our business and knew our business so well that he could tell what kind of bump he took from the sound of the bump in the ring.
I never heard that before, but I can certainly believe it. Like Roy said, he said, you know, Leroy could tell you what everything that was going on. I never realized that he was actually a commentator. So let's jump back to you mentioned the Funks and that feud that ran all over the South. I remember Rob and I watching you guys work with Terry and Junior in Florida on a lot of occasions. Rob was in and out of there a lot. I was there steady from 1970 to 1974. And wow, the matches you guys had. I mean, we never left the building when you guys were going to be working because we wanted to watch the whole darn thing. And how many times you figure you ever worked with those guys?
Boy, that's a great question. I wish I knew. Dory Funk has a list of the Funk Briscoe duels, whether it was the combination of Dory Sr., Jr., and Terry against me, Jack, and somebody else, or me and Jack against any combination of the three of the Funks. But we were fortunate. Well, like I said, there was five athletes counting the old man and he was a state champion wrestler out of Indiana. I don't know if he was ever aware of that, but Dory Sr. was a certified state wrestling champion out of Indiana.
And no, I never knew that.
He could go too. So we just had that combination, and you know, you know yourself. It's even though you like a guy and you respect a guy, there's a competitive level with him. You don't want somebody outdoing you. So I believe the four of us brought out the best in each other. When it was a Funk Briscoe match, you'd look across that ring, you see Dory or Terry or Dory Sr., you knew that you were going to have to pick it up for everything that you had in your system, your body, or you were going to get left behind.
Yeah.
If you had that competitive spirit, you wasn't going to get left behind. So the fans were the benefactors of that because you had three or four guys out there, five guys, whatever the numbers were, that was going to bust their ass each and every night that bell rang until the bell rang at the end of the match and people got their money's worth.
And they always did. That was for sure. You know, same thing with Jack and Junior and the matches they used to have when Junior was champion. I never left the building.
60 minutes so many times. It was
about
a minute.
Yeah, the hours they did was just amazing. Oh. And I remember as a young guy just getting into the business, and they'd be on the main event, and I'd be on the second match, first match, you know, early in the card. And I would see young guys leaving. And I was like thinking, what in the hell are you doing? You know, I mean, if you're not going to watch this match, you know, how the hell do you ever think you're going to be somebody, you know? And I relished those opportunities to sit there and watch those hour broadways and just, wow, just in true amazement at those matches. And that's what, you know, that was what really, in my opinion, built Florida, that territory, you know, that Jack set the pace there. And you had to emulate him. You had to work like him. A lot of young guys, so many young guys back in those days that were influenced by him, you know, that territory was so full of young guys, really great talent. And Jack was always the one that everybody looked up to. Hell, Mike Graham was there, and Kevin Sullivan was there, and Dick Slater was young. Bob Roop was young. My brother was there. Jimmy Golden, my cousin, was there watching those guys. Ken Mantell, Bob Orton Jr. I mean, the list just goes on and on. The influence that you guys had on them.
A Hall of Fame list on the card every night. You're exactly right. For guys to stay and watch a match, as you know, that's the ultimate compliment. And some of those matches over the Bayfront Center where Jack and Dory would go an hour to 90 minutes, the backstage curtain never got empty. I mean, it was packed just like the ringside was. And you mentioned some guys there, but you know, the whole philosophy of those matches, it goes way back, Ron, as you know. It goes back to your dad, your uncle, the Welches that kind of created the scene when Eddie came in and kind of joined Eddie and then kind of gave Eddie the philosophy on how to build a territory, how to build a business. And I think that the Gossetts, which was the Grahams, the Welches and the Fullers, with one family, but they kind of set a philosophy for Southern wrestling, not only in Florida, but Georgia and the Tennessees and Alabama that was copied for decades and decades. And all those territories were successful because of that philosophy that your family helped develop and pass on to guys like you and me and my brother and your brother and Jimmy Goldens and the Slayers and the Grahams and the Kearns and the guys like that. But it was truly a family dynasty with the Welches and the Fullers and the Grahams back in those days. But they had that philosophy in the South. And I used to hate it. Well, we don't do it like that in the South. Well, you don't want to make money. You don't want to draw money because this is the recipe that made money. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And so I never quite understood that philosophy, but you know what? Sure, slowly and surely they all developed that where you got those young, outstanding athletes.
Yeah. And you got, when I worked other territories, and I'm sure you did too, you could see the difference. And you could see where they weren't working programs and they weren't getting guys over properly. And they were just not doing the type of things that my granddad had started doing and Herb and his brothers from way, way back in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, they did kind of set a tone for wrestling in the South. And I appreciate you saying that, you know, not many people recognize the family name sometimes. And those guys did put in a hell of a lot of time and they kind of set a tone for wrestling in the South that made it different than other parts of the country and other places in the world.
Well, I think it was totally different because I think it was more athletic, and I think we kind of were trained to make it more of a contest, and I think that was the whole deal. And a lot of storytelling going on there, and a lot of backstories. They set that philosophy where it was a competitive nature, and they booked guys against each other that they felt were competitive guys. They didn't always go towards the money guys on top. They did what the people would walk out of there talking about on top. And I think that was the key to success for all that generation of promoters back there. And the ones that followed, the ones that knew what they were doing, that put the guys on top, that could make the guys, let people walk out. That's what you're going to remember, is that last match. I mean, you, the semifinals, you might work your angle to come back with, and they're going to remember that, but they're going to be talking about that last thing they saw. Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk going 90-minute Broadway, and at the end of that 90 minutes, the last 2.5 minutes, everybody, all 6,000 people, sold out arena, were on their feet, standing on their chairs, cheering. Why? It was because of the philosophy of the match and the storytelling, how they did it.
Yeah, and they did it a lot of times without a single punch. I mean,
well, they did a lot of times without a single word to each other, too. As you know, the dressing rooms were in separate ends of the building, so, you know, you didn't get to talk a whole lot to your
right.
opponent out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You just went out there and did it by feel and by sound of the audience, you know, and you had to be that sort of athlete that could change on a drop of a penny. You know, if they're quiet out there for several minutes, why are they quiet? We need to do something going without getting in a hurry and rushing things and messing up the course of the match. They just changed the pace a little bit and picked it up and got them back on their feet.
All of that's gone forever, seems like, you know.
I mean, that's sad. That's a sad case, sir.
Yeah, yeah. It's not done that way anymore, and I don't know that it ever will be done that way again. You know, it just,
I don't know if it'll work anymore. I mean, you know, a good match will work at any generation, but you know, just a card full of them. And that's what we were blessed to have. We were blessed to have guys on that second or third match that could work as good and then perform as good as those guys on that last match. But there was just something a little separate that set those guys apart. The reason why they were on that first match, and the reason they were on that last match, and maybe they could go a little bit longer and keep that intensity up. But whatever it was, it worked, and they had a great philosophy.
Yeah, it certainly did. It certainly did. I want to thank you. You know, you and Jack. When I left Florida and I went and got my first territory started in Knoxville, Southeastern, I brought you guys in the first April I was there in 1975. I don't know if you even remember it. I wrestled Jack for the world title and the Coliseum is one of the first nights we ever ran in the big building. That had never been done there in Knoxville before. And when I went up there, I looked at it and, you know, big old facility, and they were running out in a little place called Chilhowee Park. And I kept thinking, you know, if I could buy this town and I could get to where we could wrestle in this big building every week, like every other big city in the South, you know, how successful that would be if I could make that happen. And I brought you and Jack in on a show in April of 1975, and you wrestled my brother. You were Georgia champion. You wrestled Rob, and I wrestled Jack in the main event. And that was the only time I think we ever did that in Southeastern. But I really thank you guys for coming and setting the tone. I mean, fans back in those, they were accustomed to Ron Wright, right? And you're probably familiar with Ron Wright's style.
Oh, yeah.
And it was far away from Jack's style and your style. And,
it was a brawling style. It was a fighting style.
There you go. And, you know, when that, I wanted to have you guys on a card, I wanted so badly, I knew it was the future of my business. If I could teach those fans to enjoy wrestling as much as they had that brawling for all those years, and matches like we had that night, me and Jack and you and Rob, went a long way to making that happen. Now, eventually, Terry Funk comes in and Junior come in, and we were able to change the whole mindset of people that had seen brawling all their lives to beginning to really appreciate, not just appreciate, but enjoy real wrestling.
Well, that's exactly right. I remember that night. I remember we were honored to come up there, and Jack always enjoyed getting in the ring with you. He was always worried because of your length. You know, you were so much taller than everybody. But the mark of a good performer, a good wrestler in the ring, is somebody that can take somebody with different body size, different philosophy, and just work them into your style of match. And Jack had that magic, you know, whether it was the respect the guys had for him or just his style, whatever it was. But he had that magic, as a lot of guys did back in that era. I mean, we were blessed to see so many outstanding guys. I kind of sit back and I think, wow, what a great time. You know, we got to see the greatest, you know, from the Kaniski, from the O'Connors to the Fezzes, you know, those guys there. And you know, the list just goes on of the great guys. And, you know, and even still today, the Stone Cold Steve Austins, the Dwayne Johnsons, they got a Shawn Michaels, the guys like that who could get over. A lot of guys ask me a question, could these guys got over when you're wrestling? My theory is if you could get over in any era, I think you could get over in any era, you know, because yeah. you're a good worker. You have that philosophy. It's not exactly what you're doing in the ring, but it's when you do it and how you do it and the story that you're telling behind it. And if you're a good storyteller, storytellers are for eternities. You know, high spot guys are for that 6 months of that high spot is over. Then it's over, you know, but a good storyteller in the ring in a match will be over forever.
Yeah. But kind of what you're saying, man, is if you got it, you got it, you know, and it wouldn't make any difference what generations you're wrestling in, what time frame you're wrestling in. You just had it. And I was lucky enough, and I'm sure you were too. I got to work with Gene Kaninsky in St. Louis. I got to work with Lou Thesz four or five times in different cities. I worked with Pat O'Connor in Knoxville, you know.
The greatest worker in my estimation that ever stepped in the ring with Pat O'Connor.
Tremendous, tremendous wrestler. And, you know, and a great guy too, a really, really great guy. I used to go in there and he was booking in St. Louis in 73. And he would take me, he said, boy, you know, can you figure a finish for this match? He would ask me to figure a finish for a match. And once I did one finish for him, I'd been in Florida with Eddie. And, you know, Eddie Graham type finish is going to be 5 minutes long. You better get a pad and a pencil and start writing down all the things that's going to happen in the finish. And
you better do them.
And you better not miss anything. And O'Connor. Yeah, I put the first finish I ever had to somebody do in St. Louis. He came to me and he said, Ron, he goes, I want you to do all the finishes the next show. Well, I said, Pat, you're the booker, man.
But what an honor it was to have a man of that stature come to you and ask you to do that. And I was blessed. I had some of the same things, you know, Pat would ask me, well, what do you think we should do in this situation? I'd tell him why, and he, well, why exactly would we do it there? And I'd have my little reasons, and he got respect for me. And once that man got respect for you, he would let you roll, and he would let you lead the match. I always thought it was an honor to go out and Pat said, okay, it's in your hands, you know. Wow, I'm going to cross the ring for Pat O'Connor, and he's telling me to call the damn match. I mean, I couldn't get over it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and when I did it for him, he finally kind of felt a little guilty, and he said, you know, Ron, I want to do something special for you. And I said, this was 73, it was 2 years, or a year before I started my first company, Southeastern. And I said, Pat, I said, someday I'm going to own my own company. And I said, I want you to come and put me over.
Wow.
And he said, I'll damn sure do it. And when I went to Knoxville, I had Pat on. Maybe my second Coliseum show, me and Pat worked. I was like, I'm going to finally get my payback here.
Ronald, something I'm glad you brought that. Something I really respect about you and your family, but mostly about you, was your businessman knowledge. I mean, you were more than just a competitor in the ring. I mean, like you said, you owned several territories, but hell, you even broke away from that, and you got into hockey. You got into hockey promotion, built your own hockey league, your own hockey arenas and stuff like that. I always thought that was amazing. I always just thought that was so damn cool that, you know, because you were a college guy and I was a college guy. We both knew, you know, hey, man, this is a great sport we're in, but it's for young people. It's for young men. And you're not going to be able to do this stuff all your life. So what the hell are you going to do with your life when you're over with? and you were one of those guys that saved your money, that worked hard, and knew the direction you were going. And like there in 73, you already knew you wanted a territory. Well, I'll tell you a little story. Back in 65, 67, when Jack first started in the business, of course, little brother, I got a job driving a ring around. Well, Cowboy Bob Clay, I don't know if you remember the Clay brothers out there, Bob and Leonard Clay out in Oklahoma. They were a couple of Leroy's suitors out there, but they ran shows during the summertime. So they let me drive the truck around, and I got to set up the ring. I got to set up the box office. I got to sell tickets. I got to make the payoffs, and I got to pay off the guys, and I got to break down, drive a truck to the next deal. But the whole reason of this story is making those payoffs, right? They take 30% over and set it over in this corner here, and I take that 70% and set it over here. Well, I had 70%. Promoter got his money. I was saying I wasn't that smart, but I would say, man, 70%. I forgot about the rent and all that stuff, but at 30%, I'd take it and divide it among 8 or 9 rasters, and I saw the difference in the size of the money. I knew right away which side I eventually wanted to be in this business, and I knew I would get there somehow, someday, and knock on wood, I was fortunate enough to get on that one side of the business, the promotional side, where the money was made. But I knew right away, and you did too, telling O'Connor that 73, then you starting your own business, your territory. I always thought that was amazing how you made those steps. And it's not easy to do steps from being a wrestler in the ring to being a promoter and running the entire shebang in the office. Not just that one show of the night, but taking care of 40, 50 guys, 365 nights a week. And that's not an easy task. And you were able to do it. Then you move on into a brand new genre of hockey. Hockey team in the South, which when you was doing it, was basically unheard of. Now, you couldn't have be without it. But you were able to see the future in front of you and knew that hockey was going to be big one day. And you are pioneering that. A lot of people don't know that, but I know that, man. I got all kinds of respect for what you did with your life after the business.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I mean, hockey was a big jump. That's for darn sure. And you're right about some things. You know, when I started thinking about hockey, and I went and saw a professional hockey game, first one I ever saw, it had a small crowd and nothing happened in the first period. I mean, there was the most boring start of the game I'd ever seen. And in the second period, two guys had a fight. They dropped their gloves, and the people had been sitting on their asses all night. And when they dropped those gloves, those people stood up. Boy, I said to myself, by God, I can identify with this part of it, man. I said, this I can see, right? And I was really at a lucky time frame. Wayne Gretzky, greatest hockey player of all time, was up there in Canada. And there was talk that he was going to maybe get traded to the L.A. Kings. And I had a couple of friends that just said, well, Ron, why do you think hockey's going to be? I said, guys, if Wayne Gretzky goes to Los Angeles, a media capital of America, I said, hockey is going to be huge in this country. And, you know, they said, well, let's take a shot at it. And we did. And you know, I ended up going in there and bringing wrestling to that sport, because they'd never had it before. They had the worst beginnings to hockey games that I'd ever seen. No hoopla, no crowd standing up, no nothing. And first team I got, I darkened the buildings. I had spotlights going all over the floors. I played bad to the bone, and I introduced my team. And the two NHL owners came to Nashville to see it because they heard I was a wrestler, and they wanted to see what I was going to do to hockey. And they came into the dressing room, into my office after the first period. They watched this introduction. And wow, I'm saying, you talk about popping a crowd. People were expecting that same old dead shit type of introduction. And all of a sudden, the building went black and bad to the bone. And they introduced the players each one at a time. Just a phenomenal introduction. Everybody in the building stand up. The two NHL guys came in my office. They were pissed. They were mad. They were going, what are you doing to hockey? They said, you can't do this. And I said, the hell I can. I said, I'm in the minor leagues and I own this damn team, man. I said, I'm in Nashville. I said, they don't know anything about hockey here. I want to entertain these people. I'm going to get them to come back every week until they learn the game, and then I'm going to have a solid business. And they went out of there pissed as hell, and I went away smiling a few years later, man.
And a year or so later, they're doing the same damn thing, and it ain't.
Oh, everybody. It ain't just hockey. It went to pro basketball. It went to every damn sport that's indoors and even outdoors. I mean, you know, everybody picked it up, and it all came from wrestling. It all came from the concept we were doing in wrestling back at those time frames.
And, well, that's what I mean. We were so fortunate to be in the business that we did, because it lighted up so many other avenues. You see so many sports now that's evolved, and our sports evolved. And I love the athlete that we have in our business today. And guy said, well, sometimes you sound like a bitter old man. I'm not a bitter old man. I'm proud as hell to come from where I came from. I'm proud of that era and that generation that we came from. But you know what? I see these kids out there. They're risking their life and their limb every day when they go out in that ring. I have so much respect for them. I think the athletes of today's professional wrestling are as good as we were, or sometimes better. They're in much better shape because of the science of nutrition and all that other stuff. So that they're in great shape. They look awesome. They can do these fantastic moves. But I just worry about the longevity of their careers. But they make so damn much money early, you know, that maybe they'll need those long careers like we did. But everything evolved. Our business has evolved. Vince McMahon has brought more to the sport of entertainment, the business of entertainment, I should say, than just about anybody. But there were those original pioneers like your family and my family that deserve a lot of credit also.
Yep, I think so. And, you know, I the thing that gets me, and I watch today's matches, is how dangerous I see them do these jumping over the top rope on people on the floor, and all these awesome bumps that are just like, oh, man, are you out of your mind? I mean, if somebody had told us back in the day, we want you to run and jump over the top rope on this guy that's on the floor, we would have gone, what the hell are you talking about?
Exactly. But we would have done it probably.
Oh, yeah, we probably would have, you know. And like you say, some of them don't last long because that's dangerous stuff. And obviously, people are going to get hurt when they do those type of things. So, Japan, you'd mentioned Australia. How many times you go to Japan?
I went to Japan about a half dozen times. I'm one of the strange guys. I would, you know, a lot of guys went to Japan so many times, but I was once again, I would go back to how fortunate I was. I was always really lucky because you kind of went to Japan for filler dates in between territories and stuff like that. Well, you know yourself, if you got over in the South, you could work Georgia, Florida, and Carolinas, and you could stay in that area for years and never really have to move too far. So you didn't have a lot of those transitional moves because, well, I'll take 6 weeks and go to Japan. So fortunately, I was always busy at a high-profile angle that would allow me to leave whatever territory I was working for 4 to 6 weeks, and that's what they wanted back in those days. They didn't want those one- or two-night scripts unless you were Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk, or Hardy Race, you know, go come over, defend the belt for one night. They wanted you over there to get the money out of you for 4 to 6 weeks. Well, the promoters didn't want to leave, let the top guys go for that long, so I was really restricted during that time where Japan, everybody's going to Japan so many times. So I probably made about a half dozen trips over there, but I enjoyed every one of them. I was with Giant Bubba and Oki, Jumbo Tsuruta, and all those guys, and working with the best of guys over there. Really enjoying myself. But like I said, I was always blessed to be involved at a high money, high profile angle in the territory I was working in. And the promoters didn't want to let you go for 5 or 6 weeks.
Yeah, it was hard. And, you know, once I got my own company started, I kind of got to where I could do what I want to. I only went to Japan one time, you know, and I went work for Obama. Spent some time there with, and thank goodness, the Junior and Terry were on the whole tour. Flair came in on the end of it. And Junior and Terry, I don't know if they did the same type of things when you were there. But I mean, those guys, They were nuts. They entertained not just the boys and the crew. They entertained the Japanese people doing this crazy shit in the train stations and the airports and all this stuff. It was an experience.
I got one of my best stories of memories of Japan is we're on a boat. We're going to one of these little islands. So we went to this little island. We were there. We landed. We docked at, like 10 o'clock in the morning. So we had all that day. We didn't have a show that night, but we had a show the next night. So we walked from the docks over to the hotel, which wasn't very far. On the way there, we saw a junkyard. Well, I'm Briscoe Brothers Body Shop. I know a junkyard and want to see one. So we go over. Carrie and I were walking together. We see this pile of motorcycles over there. So we asked the guy, hey, any of them run? No, all broke. So I'm thinking, body shop. Hell, there's 50 motorcycles there. You can put three or four of those together. I bet you I can get one of those things, one or two of those damn things running. You know, so I even might. We told Mr. Vivian. We went over there and tinkered around. Okay, Terry, this one needs a spark plug. Terry, this needs this. So, you know, I'd damn Liza and Terry do the labor. So we actually got two of those damn motorcycles running. We paid the guy $50 a piece, told him we just wanted them for a couple of days. So, yeah, oh no, bad. So Joe Gucci comes along. He's a translator. Finally, he talks to the Japan guy. We the guys have to get $50 a piece for them. So we drove them out there, drove them to the hotel. Of course, this is a fishing island. You know, at 8 o'clock in the evening, the damn village closes down. So Terry and I have these motorcycles. There's a couple of bars, fishing bars, open on the other side of the island. So these motorcycles have no damn mufflers to them. So they're making all kinds of noise. So we're out there playing around, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Here comes every cop on the damn island. There comes Joe Gucci, the giant Bubba down. Hey, guys, you got to settle it down. So they took our keys away from us. We're not letting play with the motorcycles anymore. We got them back the next day. So that night, we were leaving, getting ready to go on the boat, the ship. And I said, Terry, what are we going to do? He said, God damn it, Briscoe, I'm going to dry mine off in the ocean. What are you going to do? I said, I'm going to get mine to a little kid. I'm going to be a baby. So I found me a little kid. I went over, gave him the keys to it, and mama smiling, everybody smiling here. I'm a baby face. So Terry gets on that motorcycle. He starts that up, revs it up, starts towards the end of that damn dock. He's flying. Okay. Is he really going to go off with that thing? So about 50 feet from the damn edge of the dock, he does an evil Knievel, and he rolls off the side of that thing. That bike keeps on going. The bike goes into the damn ocean. And Terry starts rolling. He had about maybe a roll and a half finished before he hit the damn ocean. Everybody screamed, Terry, don't fall. And he gets up and everybody's applauding. Of course, Terry takes his bow and all that stuff. I said, Bishop, I think I broke my arm. He's so weighed up by the gravel and he can't hardly work the next night. But Terry being Terry, he puts bandages over it and goes out and makes a story out of it. And that's the match of the night.
I'll tell you, man, I'll tell you what he did one time when I was there on the entire tour. He had gotten a part in the Rhinestone Cowboy, the movie. And he brought a guitar. He had a guitar and he couldn't play a guitar and he certainly couldn't sing. Right. And he telling me, he says, Ron, he goes, I got a part in the movie. By gosh, I'm going to sing, And so he would travel on the plane and on the trains and stuff. And he would sing his and the Japanese people would put their hands over their ears and he just kept doing his deal. He didn't care, right? So one day we go into an airport one day in probably, I don't know, Tokyo or wherever it was, big train station it was. And they got this game going. I don't know if Dave ever did this where you saw it, but Terry went over against the wall and the crowds would always come, when the wrestlers were there, there'd be mobs of people around. So they're in the main part of the terminal. There must be 2,000 people around. And Terry and Junior start screaming at us, and Junior says, let's play the game, Terry. And Terry goes over and draws a big circle on the wall. Have you ever heard this one? You ever seen this game they did?
Yeah, but go ahead.
All right, he throws a big circle on the wall, and then he goes back and he covers his eyes with his hands. Terry does, and Junior points him in the right direction, and he goes over and he's supposedly trying to stick his finger in the circle. And he misses it, and the Japanese, they pop a little bit, no big pop. And then they start looking, you know, and they're talking to each other in English, and the Japanese can't understand. And they're looking for somebody, you know, they're going, do you see one? You found her? You found her? That type of deal. And then they bring up another guy, and they bring up a third person. And then finally, they find this little Japanese woman. And she's way in the back. She's got the little thing on her back. Now she's all bent over. And they bring her up in front of the whole crowd. And now everybody knows the game, and the crowd's getting into a little more pop every time they do the deal. But this time, so she puts her hands over her eyes, and she puts her hand out in front of her with her finger. And Terry goes over and draws the little circle on the wall, but it's down real low, you know, it's because she's short, small.
Right.
And then she starts walking across toward him. And he goes over and pulls his pants down. And he has no underwear. His big old ass is sticking out there. And she almost sticks her finger in it. And as she's walking, the crowd is just building. They're like, oh, as soon as he drops his pants, there's a pop. But then it just gets bigger and bigger as she gets closer to sticking her finger in his butt. And then there's a big, huge pop. She actually touches his rear end two or three times, and then she moves her hand, and oh, she can imagine what they. Oh, I mean, they do that deal, right? And I watch it, and I'm thinking, gosh, how in the world did they get away with this? So, a couple nights later, Terry knocks on my door. He don't knock on the door. You know, I have the little doorbells on the rooms in Japan, and he rings the doorbell. It's like 2 a.m. or something. And I go, I go away, you know, you leave me alone. And he goes, Oni ninji nisma. Sounds like a little Japanese woman out there. So he does that to me about 4 times. So I go open the door, and he comes in. He's got a 6-pack of beer, and he's all down. He's all depressed. His head's hanging down. I go, what's wrong, Terry? And he goes, oh, Ron. He goes, I just got a call, man. He says, I lost my part in Rhinestone Cowboy. So I said, no, Terry, you're kidding. I said, your song is getting good, man. You know, you're going to be a star. And he goes, I said, why? And he goes, well, Ron, he goes, you know that little game me and Junior played in the airport there, you know, a couple of days ago? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, I made a real big mistake. He said, I played that game with the director of the movie, with the cast all there. He said, I got fired. Over there and working those places, they made that livable. As hard as that was being in Japan, those guys.
It was hard. People don't realize how hard it was. You know, especially, like I said, back in our day, we didn't have those 2 or 3 day tours. We had those, you know, week long tours. We had those 4 to 6 weeks. And you're over there, I mean, it's fun in the beginning. And I love the country, love the people and all that. But damn, I miss America while I'm over there.
Oh, yeah, you want to come home so bad, man. It's like,
and we're this they got your that passport and your money, and you can't.
Oh, yeah. You know, and people don't know, you know, guys used to jump out of the hotel rooms and break their legs to be able to go home early because they couldn't get out any other way. And, you know, it's tough working over there. They're big time tough. So, you know, I usually tell with these things, Jerry, I take a little time with guys, and Brian is so good. He's the knowledgeable guy about things that I didn't keep up with and I don't know much about. And I always bring Brian in on every show to ask a few questions because he goes in a different direction than I do. And if you don't mind, I'm going to turn Brian loose with you a little bit and he'll take you in a little different direction.
Turn him loose.
All right. Well, let's see how long this being turned loose lasts for here on the show. But, Jerry, I was curious about you and Georgia because there have been so many stories told about different things with Georgia, especially towards the end. So just wanted to actually get your perspective and your take on things. Now, you talked earlier about how you realized early in your career that you wanted to be a promoter. You wanted to be on the end where the money was. Jack got, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, he got 5% of the Georgia office after the war started because Eddie gave it to him. He realized how important Jack would be for the Atlanta office. You later on purchased your percent in the office from Buddy Colt. Is that correct?
I got my first 2.5% from Buddy Colt, correct.
You got your 2.5%. So now you and Jack were both in there. Do you remember where you were when you heard about the Atlanta War happening, when you heard about Ann Gunkel and Tom Renesto and that entire crew turning their back on the NWA?
Yes, I remember exactly where I was. I was in North Carolina working for Jim Crockett Sr. at the time.
And your brother
and
would
Jack
end up
was
being...
in Florida. Jack was in Florida, and Jack was making shots up there, and Jack called me, said, and asked me, because we were, like any brothers in the business, we were fairly close. And he said, I got a chance to get in promotional business. What do you think? I said, let's go for it, jump for it. You know, he said, well, let's take this and that. And I said, Jack, go for it, you know. And back in those days, if you were a really talented young man that had a lot to offer the business, these promoters wanted you to be a part of it. They didn't want to lose you. So Jack was, you know, young Jack Briscoe, there was nothing like him. You know, good-looking guy, good-looking athlete, and could talk to anybody on any level. And so they figured getting Jack in was an asset. So Buddy Cote was also in. Buddy was a great heel and also was a tremendous businessman. But Buddy got an airplane crash, and when Buddy had that crash, he needed some cash. And so I was fortunate. Like I said, I was blessed. I was working Carolina, then Florida, back and forth, hitting the big shows. And so I'd always been frugal with my money, so I'd saved a little bit of money. So Jack told Buddy to call me that I might want in. So it was an opening to get in, you know. So so when Buddy called, I said, of course, Buddy, I'm not on a bit of friend wanting to help you out. You know, I was going to get in promotional business. So I jumped at the opportunity. Then a couple other percentage ended up, and we ended up having the majority percentage to make that deal with them.
Now, I want to ask you about the famous story with you and your brother and Ole Anderson, but before we get there...
Which one?
Well, that's a good point. But in 1982, Bill Watts sells his 10% to Ole. So now Ole's in the office, not just as a booker and a talent, but also as one of the owners. And it's shortly after that that him and Fred Ward, for the most part, forced Jim Barnett out of the company. What did you and Jack think about the inner workings of the office at that period of time? Bill Watts selling his stock to Ole and then Jim Barnett being pushed out of the company.
Well, really, I mean, that kind of set the precedent for what Jack and I did with Vince, because that stock deal was made. I mean, and Fuller will know better than anybody that at our old time stock agreements, I mean, if you had stock and it was for sale, you had to offer it to the existing stockholders or have a special vote on it. And they just decided to go ahead and make the deal that Bill's going to sell to Ole and without consulting anybody. Bill was like that. Bill was a bully. And I'll tell that to Bill's face. Bill, I've known Bill since I was 11 years old. He's been a bully. When I was 11 years old, bullying around 11 year old and kicking me out of my own bed in my house to bully me around when I was an adult. So Bill's going to do what he wants to do, but that turned out to be a blessing to Jack and I, because I won't tell the complete story, because you know what? Sometimes you just want to hold faith back to, because I've been approached by a book, and you know, maybe they buy the book and get the full story. But to abbreviate the story, when they did that, we were shocked that Ole was in, and we didn't completely ever agree with Ole. And the funny thing about Ole, Ole was one of my favorite guys to get in the ring with, because he was another one like the punks that would push you. And if you didn't push back, he ate the hell out of you. So I wasn't going to get eaten up. So once again, you dug down deep and you fought back and you did the best match you could do. So I respected Ole as a competitor in the ring, but as a person and as a businessman, I had no respect for his shenanigans there. So, but that was a blessing, because when we decided to sell to Vince, Ole was the first one to bring up the bylaws. Hey, if stock is for sale, you got to offer it to a stockholder before you can offer it to somebody else. Of course, Vince wasn't a stockholder, and Ole was, so he felt we should have offered it to them. But we did go around. We offered it to other members of Georgia Championship Wrestling, even offered it to the Jimmy Crockett Jr. and the Murdoch brothers that was running Raleigh and Virginia for them. And once again, Ole said, well, they're trying to screw you. They're wanting too much for my for the stock and all this stuff. And here he's trying to buy it from us. So we did that. We offered all that. So when we finally approached Vince, and Vince said, yeah, I'll buy it. Well, one of Ole's biggest contention was Section 5, Paragraph 4, Article 3, where it says, if the existing stock is for sale, you got to offer it to existing stockholders first. Oh, yeah? Well, how did you get your 10%? Nobody told us that 10% was available. No, you don't know about it. So he had already set the president, so he had actually screwed himself on that entire deal. So, but it was nobody was happy about Ole becoming a stock owner at that time. To answer your question.
Ole has said that one of the reasons that him and Fred Ward pushed out Jim Barnett was that Jim Barnett was taking company money and not putting any back in. And you were an owner. You were someone who collected a dividend. Was that what, in fact, was happening? What did you think about Jim Barnett getting pushed out?
Well, I did not like the fact that Jim Barnett got pushed out because Jim Barnett gave me my first break in Australia. And he taught me so much about the business side of the profession I was in. And I, as we both said a long time ago, I knew that was the side. Barnett always told me that's going to be the side that you're going to end up on and do well in. And so I had a lot of respect for Jim. I was really mad at him that when this happened, that he allowed that to happen. And then they ganged up on him and went out. But the truth is, Ole was taking about 5 paychecks for ever. I think he was taking one for sweeping out the office floors, but I don't think he had Bobby Simmons. And I love Bobby to death, but it was kind of one of those forceful takeovers. So, you know what? You're not going to screw two Indians for very long. You might screw them for a while, but we're going to figure out a way to get even. So we put a plan together, and we made it work.
You know, before we started recording, I was talking to Ron briefly about some of this, and Ron had never heard the story of, for lack of a better term, the blood oath. Could you tell Ron what happened with you and Jack and Ole?
Well, once again, that's really the blood oath. The night we flew up there somehow, and I think it was leaked through our dear friend Jim Barnett that we were going to be there. So all the guys, we always stayed at a certain hotel up there because we got a rate. You know, we're cheap, so we wanted to go where the rate is. But Jack and I talked, hey, you know, if Ole finds out, he's going to know where we're staying. So we even switched hotels. We stayed at a different hotel. We went to a church. Taylor had him get us a Denver hotel under his name. Somehow, Ole had found out about us being there. He shows up at the bar. Little be known to anybody that he also had the Road Warriors waiting out in the parking lot, you know, and he had offered a little bounty. Anybody that could beat Jack and I up, he would pay them, you know, several thousand dollars for it. And Animals are the one that came up to me. Which one is Laurinaitis?
Animal.
Animal came up to us in Cleveland and told us about the deal. He said, Ole's offered that. He said, we told him to go F himself. You guys meant too much to us and helped us out so many times in so many different places. We're not going to do it, but just beware if you're working for anybody else, that somebody might try to hurt you out there. And, of course, we kind of laughed at it. Come on, you know. We'd already been in the business a long time. A lot of people have tried and failed, you know. So wasn't too worried about it. But we're getting all kinds of calls and deals. But the bottom line is when Ole took over, it was a completely different situation. It was chaos. And Jack and I actually had the dream that Vince had, you know, to go nationwide. We were wanting to go nationwide. And that's another reason why Jim kind of got ixnayed out of there, because he was wanting to do just Georgia, you know, just where we're Georgia Championship Wrestling. But we had that TBS station that was hot and it was everywhere in the world, or the North America. So we took like Ohio, Michigan, that she had burned up and killed, and nobody wanted to promote in there because it was so hot from the promoter being a dick. And so I went up in that area, and And Ralph, really gave Ralph a lot of props on that. Ralph and I went up there. We mended a lot of fences, and make a long story short, we turned that into a money-making deal. And Ole was making money off that. He divided it up where he, because with the Ward and Ole, they had a majority. But and Ronald, remember this guy, Paul Jones, one of the original owners, he was an old-time shooter, old-time wrestler. So we really liked Jack and I because of our athletic ability. So we had Paul on our side. We never really pushed it, but with Paul swinging to our side, that gave us over 50% that we needed there. And so we had that, and that's when we made contact with Vince and did our deal with Vince.
And Ole wanted you guys to take a blood oath that you wouldn't make the deal with Vince.
Oh, no. Well, I'm sorry. I forgot all that. So anyway, we're in this bar, and we all had quite a bit to drink, talking business, wrestlers as they do. So we're out here. You know, we got to get up early in the morning. Oh, it'll come up. So we kind of figured Ole's kind of going to try to start some trouble because the atmosphere of our little table there started getting more aggressive as the night goes on. And, you know, I started out, you know, the old man is great working with you, blah, blah, but I'm pretty soon, you're an asshole, and all that stuff. So it was starting to go the wrong direction. So we said, let's call it a night. So, hey, we go up. So Ole starts making deals then because we knew what Ole was doing. We knew Ole was making a paycheck for every little town up. He had worked himself into percentages of every town that we were running there illegally through his manipulation. Ole's a very, very intelligent guy. Don't ever knock Ole Anderson short of being intelligent in the business because he's highly intelligent in the business. He's just an asshole. He's there. And I'm over it, and I apologize to Ole, and I thanked him for making me a better worker in the ring. I told him I enjoyed being in the ring with you, but as a personal guy, you're an asshole. And so I right to his face, I told him that in Charlotte, North Carolina. So anyway, we go up. Hey, you guys are in Indiana. Let's do blood over all that stuff. So Ole, we got nothing. So, you know, back in those days, a lot of the hotels had, you know, complimentary razor blades, the razors, you know, in there that you could shave if you forgot your shaving kit. So he breaks his plastic razor open, takes a razor, and cuts himself. And Jack and I look, we don't want to become blood brothers as damn Polak, you know. So we refuse to do it. So he grabbed mine and Jack's hand, pulled him up against the head like it was going to magically bleed through. We just took a blood oath. We won't screw each other around. Okay. You know, whatever you think, Ole. And that was kind of that the short version of the blood oath. But it happened, and we did not cut ourselves, as Fuller can tell you. I went my whole career with only doing one blade job, and Jack went his whole career with only doing one blade job. So we did my razors to begin with. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that you guys.
So that story of the blood oath and a short version of it. Buy the book down the road, and you'll get the long version.
I'll tell you, Ole was it. You're right. Ole was an ass. And I mean, everybody knew it. It was kind of you knew up front you were dealing with a guy that was hard to deal with.
Yeah, but you know what? In the ring, Ron, as you know, he was one of the hardest workers, and a good worker, too. I mean, I cannot knock a single thing about Ole Anderson inside the ring. Outside the ring, I could write two or three books on it. But inside the ring, the guy was as good as it came.
Yep. He was certainly a great worker. Brian, you got any?
Yeah, a couple more. I'm going to ask you, Jerry, since you said no holds barred, I'm going to ask you the most sensitive question I could think to ask you right now, which is, we've heard from various people here on the Super Studcast. We've heard from Terry Funk. We've heard from various historians who have gotten in touch with us. And I'm very curious what your take is. When the match in Houston was canceled between world champion Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe, and Dory Funk Sr. and Dory Funk Jr. said that there was a tractor accident on the ranch, which caused Dory Funk Jr. to not be able to drop the belt to Jack, which messed up a lot of plans that the NWA had, that Eddie Graham had, not to say to mess up what Jack's trajectory was at that period of time. What do you think really happened? Do you think there really was a tractor accident?
Well, you've already disputed the original story that I heard. I heard it was a Jeep accident, but you know, a car accident, a Jeep accident, tractor accident, combine accident. question: was there really an accident? Was it police? Was there any type of medical report when Dory had to go to the hospital and be declared not fit to compete in a working wrestling match? And, you know, and Ron and I both been in the rings with a lot, probably severe injury in that. My thought, I was in Richmond, Virginia. I can tell you exactly where I was and when I got the news and everything. I couldn't wait to hear it. I mean, I wasn't even booked on the card. I was in Richmond, Virginia, man, Thunderbolt against Gene and Ole Anderson, probably. And so Joe Murnick, the promoter in Richmond, calls me to outside of the dressing room. We went out back of the arena there, and it was just he and I looking at it. He said, I got something you need to know. He said, your brother didn't get the title tonight, because I was expecting him to tell me, hey, congratulations, your brother's world champion. So we walked outside, and he said, I got some news that you need to know. He said, here's what happened. Dory supposedly got in an accident. This Joe Murnick telling me this, and couldn't make Houston. Well, Ron and I both know that back in those days, you made the damn towel. You made the towel, you know, and so he didn't lose the title. But a title is being postponed, pushed off to a later date, or whatever. Nobody knew when the later date was going to be. And Jack was still supposed at that time to get the title from Dory. Well, who knows the real truth except for Dory and Dory Sr.? And I don't even think Terry knows the real story, because I've gotten Terry so damn drunk he's told me everything about the thing that he knows. So who knows? That's a sign. But were we pissed off? Hell yes, we're pissed off. And as Fuller can tell you here, back in those days, here's what you did before you became a champion. What really hurt Jack so much, and his, as you say, his trajectory towards stardom, as he was such a star, he very rarely got beat. But when you're getting ready to be the world champion, back in those days, the NWA sent you to every territory in the entire world, and you did nothing but jobs for guys that some of those territories, they had guys that couldn't even lace up their own boots, let alone be in the ring with Jack Briscoe. And Jack had to go into every one of these territories and put every Joe Schmuck over right in the middle of the ring, 1, 2, 3. So that when he came back with the world title, the promoters had this from, hey, well, old Joe Blow beat you in Tupelo, Mississippi in 9 minutes, and here's the footage, you know. So that kind of ruined Jack's trajectory and this went on for like a year and a half, them building Jack up to get the title. So Jack had done jobs all over the United States. So his value and his star shining wasn't that bright as it was before by the time Jack got the belt a year and a half later. So, and Jack was supposed to get the belt from IFL, and the story goes that they didn't want to give it to Jack for some unknown reason. So, you know, Harley Race and Goggles and Funk were like brothers. And so they worked out the deal where Harley was supposed to get the title. And Harley was mad enough coming down and dropping to Jack. So we're upset. And, you know, I mean, do I believe 100% of the story? No. Do I believe some of the story? Maybe. Do I believe there was a conspiracy? Maybe. Hey, y'all, once again, buy the book.
It's going to be some book.
That incident right there, you know, that changed my life. I was in Australia, been there for 2 months, supposed to be there for 3 months, had left Florida just starting to get pushed, and then Jack got into that position where he had to go and take those shots. In fact, he came to Australia instead of Junior at the time. And I got sent back to Florida and got pushed up on top, man. And I started, I got my first title and, you know, it changed my life. That incident y'all just talking about, it really affected me in a good way. It's just strange business, you know. it's a very, very strange business. And when you got talking about that title.
Oh, I want to reverse the tables here. I'm not the podcast host for this question. I'm going to be the podcast host because your family was deeply involved in NWA at that time, Ronald. What do you think was the real story? From an outsider, I'd like to hear that because I've never heard somebody that was that entwined in our business politics as your family was at that time. And I'm sure you heard some rumblings and you heard some stories, and they probably all don't match. So I've never heard any of those outside stories. Nobody's ever had the balls to tell me. So tell me your story.
Well, here's the deal, and this is the honest truth. My old man always kayfabed me. he never let me know anything he was doing.
I believe that.
Yeah, he never let me know anything he was doing. His business was his business, and he never called me on the phone and said, "Hey, this is going on, that's going on." Hell, when I'd go and see him, we'd hardly even talk about business. You know, I mean, I had a very strange relationship with my dad, but I know he was highly involved in things back in that time frame for sure. Him and Eddie were really pushing buttons, you know. But and I didn't have the balls to say, "Hey, Dad, what's going on?" No,
I understand because I know the business during that time. It was a need to know a deal, and you didn't need to know.
Yeah, I didn't need to know, and he would have probably said, "Oh boy, I can't talk to you about that." You know, I don't know what's going on. He would just, he would have kayfabed me, literally, and you know. So I wish the hell I had known.
Okay, on a personal standpoint, can you see that happening?
Oh yeah, yeah, I can see that being a potential for that. You know. And the story I always heard from it was that, you know, Senior didn't want Dory to lose to a baby face, basically. He didn't want him, you know, and God knows that Jack was, if there was ever a champion baby face, it was Jack, you know. He had great matches. I always had great matches with Jack. I had that one in Knoxville, was the first one I ever had with him. Hell, I had three in Memphis and two in Louisville with him. And always had fabulous matches. And Jack, he could heal when he wanted to. And I know you and him healed as a tag team some, you know, you in Carolina.
That was our favorite run together that year, the 2 years that we did the heel run against Steamboat Youngblood up in Carolina.
Yeah, you know, and I've been babyface and healed back and forth three or four times. I always preferred to heal. I love to heal.
I love being a heel there, but yeah, that's a story that one day I've never really sat down with Dory Jr. and talked about it because it's just some things you don't talk about and some things you're just not ready to talk about. And I got to make that happen one day, and one day I will. I'll get Jr. story, but you know, I just still to this day I you know it was the biggest disappointing night. I remember that night, like I said, I was in Richmond, and that night, you know, Joe Murnick always took us out to dinner. I don't even think I went out to the dinner that night because I was so upset. And there were no cell phones or anything like that, so I couldn't get a hold of my brother and talk to him about what happened. But it changed the course of a lot of programs around the country, and I'm just like Ronald, it changed him for the better. I don't think it did anything pro or a negative towards my career. It just postponed what we were doing. But we still worked with the Fox, and still drew money with them and still had five-star matches every time we stepped in the ring with them. So the competition part of it really didn't, but the personal part of it, for years and years, there was that conspiracy theory that kind of drove. But you know what? We were all friends in the end, and we're still friends, and that's all that counts.
That's it. You know, and Jerry, I'm gonna let you go, my man. I mean, this has just been fascinating for me. It's the longest conversation you and I have had, you know, maybe ever. You know, and
ever.
And I wish to, you know, that I've wasted a whole lot of time, man. I mean, we have so much in common. You know, like you say, we may be almost blood brothers in a way. My family coming from out there in that same part of the country is yours. And it's just been wonderful, man, having you on and talking about not just your experiences, but Jack as well. And Jack, to me, before I let you go, I just want to tell you what Jack meant to me. Jack kind of took me under his wing when I came there in 1970, 6 months in the business. And he was a role model to me, not just me, but all those young, talented guys that were starting at that point. Jack took me, he set me down and talked to me. They had sent Jack into Madison Square Garden to work for Vince Sr. And about 3 months later, they sent me from Florida. They had the Florida tapes up there in New York back in those days, in 73, I think it was. And Jack set me down and told me what to expect when I go to the Garden. And then in 73, later in that year, I started going to St. Louis. And Jack set me down again and said, here's what you can expect, Ron. And here's how you need to work. And Jack was like a daddy to me, maybe better than my daddy. You know, just that the example of my daddy never told me a lot of things that Jack told me, to be honest with you. And I really, really loved your brother, man. Like I said, he was not only just a role model to me, but he was a role model to all those young wrestlers in the 70s in Florida and to wrestlers all over the world.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I know my brother was, he was a role model to a lot of guys. And Jack took more pride. As you know, Jack had so much confidence in his ability. I mean, you know, people nowadays, you know, winning and loss, losing. You know, Jack knew it was a business, and Jack knew that he could take care of anybody that was across the ring from him. So he never really got into that winning and losing so much, you know, because you don't win. You're selected to win. You know, promoters have confidence in you. That's what you win. You know, somebody told Dory said, I won a title that night. And it, well, you didn't win a title. You were selected to win the title. Yeah. So let's back up a little bit. What Dory did when he won the title, just as my brother Jack did when he won the title, and anybody else that wins that title, you are winning. You have won the confidence of every promoter in the United States and won the confidence of the man that's director, president of the organization that you're going to represent. So you won him over by showing that he can have confidence in that you're going to show up and look like a professional. You're going to conduct yourself as a professional. And when you go to the ring, you're going to do business as a professional. And so that's what you win. You don't beat the guy in front of the guy lets you beat him, but you won the confidence of everybody that has a hand in selecting that title. And won their confidence over. So you do win and you do lose. And Jack was a winner that night when he won the title from Terry, just as Dory was when he won the title from Konecki, you know. So there is winning and losing, but it's not the physical winning and losing. It's the mental and the perception that you win and lose from the promoters and the people in charge, the powers that be, that they have, you win the confidence of them that you have the ability and the professionalism of carrying that prestigious title around for the organization.
Well said, man. Well said. You know, and it's honest truth. And, you know, once again, Jerry, thank you so much for being with us today. And this has been memorable for me, and I very much appreciate it. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope maybe we can do another one someday. You know?
Oh, let's just get a cold one. We'll talk about more BS than we can lie about.
Well, all right.
It's a pleasure being on this thing with you. I'm glad I know we've touched bases several times on doing it, but the respect us old timers have, it just seems like a different type of respect that we have nowadays because we know the rough times. And I look back and hell, all the way back to the 20s, your family's involved in this business. 100 years, your family has been involved in this business. That's phenomenal. It's remarkable. And it's something that more and more people should be aware of, and more people should gain knowledge from you, listening to your podcast and listening to you. So thank you for having me on, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all StudCast with your donation for this month's Super StudCast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super StudCast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super StudCast is done.